From WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, you're listening to Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I'm Sherry Russo. This is a podcast about restoring dignity and respect by giving a voice to the voiceless. The information we gathered for the life stories that we've told you about during the last two seasons seems relatively easy to come upon now. But the legwork and research that went into finding all of that information and making it available to the public took many years and involved many people in the Athens community who had to find ways to cut through layers of bureaucratic red tape. This is the last episode of season two, and today we're going to introduce you to some people in upstate New York, partially inspired by what they heard on this podcast, who are doing the hard, sometimes tedious work of unlocking the information to tell the stories of those buried in an unmarked graveyard in their community. And they're partnering with this podcast to tell the stories of some of those individuals for season three of Who Lies Beneath. Retired library archivist and Athens Asylum Cemetery researcher Doug McCabe joins us now. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Doug, I thought before we talk with those researchers in New York, we could talk a little more in detail about the challenges you and others faced here in Athens in unlocking the information that would reveal the names of those who were buried under the numbered tombstones, because we know the folks in New York have faced some similar obstacles.
Well, yeah, I mean, in my case, I had the opportunity of being the curator of the asylum collection at Ohio University's archives, where I had all the records stored there right at my fingertips. So those records included admissions indexes and a grave book, communal papers, and administrative records such as employee cards, newsletters and correspondence, and also photographs and even plot plan maps. As a curator, it was my duty to be as familiar as possible with the records, mainly to be of service to researchers and people interested in the place. Now, that prompted me to write up a brief history of the asylum and conduct even walking tours of the place. Still, this also made me deeply aware of the staff and patients, including those buried in the three cemeteries at the asylum. Seeing that most of those burials were under numbered headstones without names and dates then prompted me to create a database for all of them and make that available to researchers and descendants. These were people who deserved dignity and respect anyone ought to enjoy, and if for no other reason than they were human beings.
Absolutely.
Frankly, this ought to be made public regarding anyone placed in institutions, be they asylums, prisons, county homes, orphanages, and such. And only in this way can researchers and families not have the challenges they have faced in the past and even today.
Well, why are there so many barriers to gaining access to this information? I mean, does it have anything to do with the stigma associated with mental illness at the time, or, you know, were the barriers put in place to protect the families of these people in some way? It just seems like there's so much to cut through.
Yeah, well, barriers were put in place to gaining access of this information by administrators at the institutions themselves, politicians, medical doctors, and even some families. And to be blunt, to hide information from the public. You know, that kind of out of sight, out of mind idea. And to assign a stigma to something as a choice, and that choice has caused a great deal more harm than good, in my opinion. This is particularly the case in holding back needed advances in the treatment of mental distresses, as well as enlightening the public to abuses, but also advances and research into progressive mental health.
Well, personally, I have, you know, I've done some family genealogy, some family research because of some health issues that I wanted to see it were prevalent in my family. And that got me to thinking about this. Like, if you, some mental illness is genetic, right? And if you had that in your history, it's buried. Like, you can't find it anywhere. So in that way, shouldn't these records be available to people?
Oh, I think so. You know, HIPAA has its reasons. And I can understand it from one standpoint, but from another, as a layperson, I can't understand it. If you want to really look into the past in your own family, or in just groups of people, you should be able to do that. Now, the other part of that is, so many of those records aren't as descriptive as you would dearly love them to be. Mm-hmm. And you're also up against an evolution of research and understanding, and even language, for that matter, as to describing what mental distresses and mental illness is, and what its origins are, and what the treatments can be, and so forth. So it's not an easy thing to get into, no matter from what angle you're coming at it.
Well, the work that led to the unlocking of the names in Athens started with a small group of people who were part of the local chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, who learned that the cemeteries located at the old Athens Asylum were in a state of disrepair. One man who was part of that group was Greg Polzer. Greg talked with me recently about why the first step in restoring dignity and respect for the people buried at the old Athens Asylum was to restore the cemeteries to a place of reverence, and the importance of honoring those buried there while keeping the historical integrity of the cemetery intact.
Part of the problem was that when the state gave over the Ridges property to Ohio University, the cemeteries were left in disarray, and there was also a problem of students thinking it was kind of a spooky, scary place, and they would go up there and either have parties at the cemetery, they would steal the headstones or damage the headstones. As a matter of fact, OU was complicit in this by having something called a haunted hayride during Halloween era, which they have since changed to, instead of a haunted hayride, to a historical hayride, which of course we were very much in favor of. So it came down to mostly Tom Walker and myself to try to look around and see what was going on. At the same time, Jimmy Stewart, who was first our representative and became a state senator, he actually had a bill passed which allowed access to the people whose names were buried in the cemetery. Before that, it wasn't accessible. So with the name of the people in the cemetery with the numbers, Tom and I went around and started looking for headstones that were all around the place, and then went ahead and placed them as best we could, in the proper location. And so that started in Cemetery 1, and then it continued in Cemetery 2. The for your information, Cemetery 1, the men and women were buried in alternate rows, and in Cemetery 2, the men and women were buried in actually in two different sections, one next to the other. So it was a challenge to try to find headstone number 271 was a male or a female headstone, but We just using a little bit of determination, we're able to, I think, restore them and also be able to put them in their proper place. And once we finished, it was a really satisfying experience, because now the cemeteries are back the way they were intended, as best as we could at the time. And also, in spite of the fact that some of the headstones had to be repaired because they had been broken off, they were made of marble, and so they were a little bit brittle. But so it still to this day looks very serene, and it's a very honorable way to remember the people that are buried there, because it's NAMI's idea that, and the state supports us on this, that we wanted it to the cemeteries to look in a historical, proper way, to be able to honor the folks that lived there and died there and who were buried there. And so it was quite satisfying for me and for Tom to take on this project.
A lot of people, including me, struggle with the number and not the name being on the grave. Do you know or have you learned why numbers were chosen?
Well, I believe it has to do with, it's a combination of practicality and stigma. Practicality being having a number rather than would be able to relate to a list. And it was probably easier and cheaper to do that way. And also stigma because it was, people are embarrassed about it, I think. And what we have tried to do is to be able to find some kind of way to have, well, first of all, there are lists available both at the OU archives and also the NAMI website of all the people who were buried there, their number of their grave, and also list their cause of their death. But we tried it. We have tried, and I've kind of stepped away from NAMI Athens, but we tried to come up with some kind of either a large billboard which had all the different names on it, which became impractical. Then probably the very best thing probably would do, considering modern technology, would have some kind of an interactive digital map, maybe a dedicated laptop or a tablet on site that would be able to digitally identify the numbers and correlate the numbers with the people that were buried there, which would solve a lot of the issues as far as I'm concerned.
So I know some families have reached out to NAMI and have had a named marker placed at the site where the number is, where the numbered tombstone remains, but a flat named marker is put in its place. That is something that people can still do, correct? And it's something that helps to keep the historical integrity without changing the site too much?
Well, going back historically, you may or may not know that everything was moving along. You know, the NAMI Athens was working in sync with the state ODMHAS, which is the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addictive Services, in coordination with them to restore the cemetery to its historical look. And then when some folks came along, Doug Lockhart, a fellow from Logan, came and told us that he was walking through the cemetery and he was having people, he heard like the voices of the people who were buried there saying like, "I want to be heard," or something like that. And so he started an organization and they came to us. And we said that, you know, within reason, we would be, the NAMI would be willing to do that as it doesn't totally change or disrupt the whole nature of the place. You know, in order to put one of those little markers down, which are about 9 by 15, you also have to dig up and put in a concrete or a slab and then attach that. And if you would do that a total of about 1,800 times throughout the whole thing, it would be pretty darn disruptive, and it would change the whole nature of the thing. The NAMI's point was, okay, if some people came forward and there were maybe about, I don't know, 15 or 20 people did that, and we said, all right, and so that was okay. And then down the line, people showed up who were not genuinely related to some people whose name was buried. It's almost like they were like really they were just found to maybe have some remote connection to them. And so we talked to the state about that, and as you know now, if you go up there, you'll see a little marker saying, if you have any questions, contact them. They just took it right back and said, okay, anybody else has any questions or problems, come to see us. Because that's why where the situation is at the moment.
As Greg mentioned, there was one man who was instrumental in unlocking the information needed to be able to associate the names with the numbers, a state lawmaker who helped those working to restore the cemeteries at the Athens Asylum cut through bureaucratic red tape. Here's a portion of my conversation with former state representative Jimmy Stewart. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you for letting me join you.
How did you come to learn about the numbered tombstones at the old Athens Lunatic Asylum?
Well, I believe it was in my first term in the state legislature. Tom Walker and a couple others from the local NAMI chapter came up to Columbus, met with me, and we discussed the issue about the cemetery and the grounds of the cemetery that had really fallen on hard times over many, many decades. And Tom, at that point, was involved in restoring, putting in a trail and trying to clean up the cemeteries. They told me about the issue. I mean, I had seen one of the cemeteries before and never wasn't really that familiar with the whole history of the facility, but I was aware that there were a number of stones there, most of which did not have any name identification on it. And they had told me, explained the backstory to it and how difficult it was for folks to get those records. And so they wanted to work with me to try to release those records and make them available.
So why was it so difficult for people to be able to access the records of their family members who might have been housed at the asylum?
Well, it's actually kind of simple. It's because, in effect, they were medical records. And just as you would hope that your medical records or anyone else's would remain private between you and your healthcare provider, these folks' records were private. They're, of course, many, many decades, if not over a century, old, but they were still medical records nonetheless.
Okay, so how did you go about getting those unlocked so that these names could be put with the tombstone number?
We worked with some folks with the state, with the the Department of Names have changed, I believe. I wish I could remember the person's name, but the gist of it was we worked with the state to come up with a solution, and there was some back and forth, but ultimately we settled on turning the documents into historical documents. And once they were historical documents, they would then be released to the Ohio Historical Society, and we could take it from there.
So was this legislation that was passed, or was this just you using your influence as a state senator to try to help get this situation resolved?
Well, ultimately, yes, it did have to. It became legislation, and we were able to pass it. I think it passed the Senate unanimously, I think almost unanimously in the House as well. And, you know, I had roughly a dozen bills as a legislator that became law. And for a lot of reasons, I can't think of one that I'm more proud of than this one. I think there's a lot of symbolism behind it. And it really means a lot to me personally.
Doug, after hearing all of that from Jimmy Stewart, even though now it may seem to those listening that it's easy to tell the stories of these people who were buried at the asylum, this process was cumbersome and really took a long, long time.
Well, I've been slogging away at this off and on for over 15 years, and there's still much more to do. Importantly, the next big step is to break the logjam to allow individuals or a group to place flat markers below all the numbered headstones with the names and dates of those buried. And I have to say, I celebrate and am deeply thankful to all the people who are diligently working to right these wrongs throughout this country.
Well, now, partially inspired by our podcast, we've learned that another group is working in Rochester, New York, working to tell the story of patients at an area asylum who were buried in an unmarked section of the historic Mount Hope Cemetery. The section was referred to as the Pauper Section and contains burials from a poorhouse and a penitentiary as well. The biggest difference between the situation in Rochester and in Athens is that the Pauper Section section of Mount Hope is basically an open field with no grave markers at all. Joining us now are two members of the group working on this project in Rochester, Professor of Psychology at St. John Fisher University, Ryan Thibodeau, and University of Rochester Medical Center psychiatrist, Larry Guttmacher. Ryan and Larry, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Pleasure indeed.
Ryan, we'll start with you. Can you tell us about how you came to learn about the Mount Hope Paupers Field and its history?
Sure. Yeah. So I think it started when I learned some years ago. I've been interested in the history of psychiatry, like Dr. Guttmacher, really, for a number of years. And I learned some years ago about a story really in our community in which there was excavators or landscapers who were doing work in what is now Highland Park, which is itself a pretty historic institution right here in Rochester. And in the 1980s, the excavators essentially intruded on human graves and unearthed a bunch of human graves. And it was later learned that the occupants of those graves had were former residents of the three county institutions that you just referenced, Sherry. So one was the penitentiary, one was the poorhouse or the almshouse, and one was the insane asylum. And so those folks were there. It turned out there were upwards of 1,000 people, not quite 1,000 people, who were buried in that unmarked cemetery in Highland Park. A large number of them were removed, were disinterred from that cemetery in Highland Park, and then reinterred in Mount Hope Cemetery. And so I came to learn that after that cemetery in the Highland Park spot, which was essentially in the backyard of what was the penitentiary, I learned that after burials had ceased there, burials started in this so-called, what you call the pauper section of Mount Hope Cemetery. And so that started around probably 1870 or so. And then, so when I learned about this plot and I learned about the fact that, people were, essentially buried in unmarked graves, I think that I saw a real opportunity to learn more about them, to try hard to tell the community about these folks, to tell stories about them, to make it obvious that they were, full human beings. So really excited to embark on this work.
Ryan, do you know how many people are buried there?
I can estimate. So this the public section of Mount Hope Cemetery is essentially a large potter's field. It certainly includes a large number of folks, deceased folks, who came former residents of the penitentiary and the almshouse and the insane asylum. But it's also important to note that really anybody who would have been subject to a quote unquote indigent burial, could have found themselves there. As well. So there's only really probably a small slice of the entirety of the folks who are there who came from the institutions that have been the focus of our attention. But if I had to estimate, and certainly Dr. Guttmacher can weigh in on this as well, I would say that it would number in the thousands, I'm not sure, 3,000, 4,000, something along those lines. But I have to admit that I'm not certain about that.
Okay. Dr. Guttmacher, why did you decide to get involved in this project?
Well, like Ryan, I am fascinated by the history of psychiatry. And there's just so much we can learn about our attitudes towards the mentally ill and our ongoing fight to try to destigmatize mental illness. And this strikes me as one of the more glorious examples of our stigmatization of the mentally ill, to place these people in unmarked graves along with the paupers and the criminals from that era, carries an awful horrible message that I think we need to try to do something about. It's really an ongoing battle.
Battle is a good word because, as we've talked about in this episode, there's a lot of obstacles that, that we came up against here in Athens. And I've heard that you guys have come up against in your efforts. Ryan, can you talk about what obstacles you've faced so far?
Sure. Well, one thing that I will say is that it's not extraordinarily easy to learn about the folks who are buried there. I mean, in some sense, we can learn some things because we have been in the fortunate position that Mount Hope Cemetery's burial records are very, very detailed, and they've been fully digitized, and they're online, and they're really accessible to anybody. So anybody can go to this database and find out about, you know, who's there and the date of death and causes of death and where in the cemetery that they're buried. And so in that sense, we've been very, very fortunate that those records are very detailed and so easily accessible. But on the other hand, though, you know, beyond that, learning about the folks who are buried there, you know, beyond that, in terms of the details of their lives, that's, I think it's fair to say, has been much, much more challenging. We've been fortunate enough to be able to take advantage of a trove of records from the county asylum that are in the possession of a minor library at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And so we've learned, you know, a little bit about some of the patients who are buried there, and we've been very fortunate in that. I think it's also fair to say, however, though, that those records are not really extraordinarily detailed. And so although we've learned some interesting and important things, there are lots of unanswered questions as well, lots of question marks. And so in some cases, we've been able to fill in some of the question marks by, you know, consulting other sources and other databases and so on. But it has been, you know, and so in several cases, we've been lucky enough to be able to piece together some interesting, you know, sort of timelines of, you know, patients and the details of their lives. But it really has been quite a, I think I would say, a laborious process for sure.
Well, let me add that this is also very much an ongoing issue. So in one of my former lives, I was the clinical director of the state hospital in Rochester. And the history is that there was a Monroe County asylum until 1891, at which point New York State took it over, as it did all of the other county institutions. As clinical director, I would probably on almost a weekly basis get a letter from a relative of someone who had been hospitalized at the state hospital, wanting to know about their family history. And the Office of Mental Health has a stance which says that HIPAA, which ensures patient privacy, goes forever, unlike most everywhere else, which says there's a 50-year limit. So the patient's grandmother's record may well be sitting down in the basement. I may have access to all kinds of information, but I wasn't allowed to share it. So these families and were kept in the dark about their relative, again, I think furthering this idea of stigma that somehow grandma would be so ashamed that she'd been in the hospital that we should pretend that it wasn't true. So this is very much an ongoing issue and very problematic from my perspective.
Doug, you know, we've talked about on this podcast how there are similar cemeteries in communities across the country. Ryan and Larry have laid out how they're coming up against some of the same obstacles that you guys came up against in Athens when you were doing this work initially. This isn't going to be an easy process for anyone looking to do this, right?
Well, it's never easy to expose what has been intentionally hidden for so long. I guess that is what makes these projects seemingly daunting as well as challenging. Yet the rewards and accomplishments make it all worthwhile.
Yes, that absolutely is true. And listening to Ryan and Larry talk, Doug, I'm hearing the same things that we've been saying about, you know, they're people and they deserve to have their stories told, which is what makes it worth it. So, Larry, what do you hope the result of your work here is?
Well, the result, I hope, is, you know, Ryan has created some lovely plans for basically a monument, a place where people can sit, where we can get some information out about the people who are buried there, a place for some quiet and reflection. I hope we will have a proper unveiling of this and we can tell some of this story and use this as a way to mirror society's attitudes, which are evolving. You know, it's not that there isn't hope. We are doing better. We got a long way to go. But our attitudes towards the mentally ill, and to tell the story that these were very much human beings who deserve to be recognized.
Absolutely. Ryan, we're working with the both of you, and we're going to, we're announcing this kind of right now, we're going to make the Mount Hope Cemetery Pauper's Field and the stories of the people buried there the focus of Who Lies Beneath Season 3. You mentioned this a little bit earlier. Can you give us some detail about a couple of the people that you've been able to research who are buried there and their stories?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have, I think at this point, 8 or 9 patients for whom we have some, you know, we think nicely detailed information. It's certainly not comprehensive. We don't know everything about these folks and the circumstances that led them to the asylum. But there are, 8 or 9 people who we feel we have some pretty good, interesting stories about. And to give you a couple examples, there was, you know, one person for whom we have probably the most detailed information was a Mr. William Ruby, and he was a Civil War veteran. He enlisted right around the start of the conflict, and I'm excited to tell everybody about him and his life. He actually became pretty severely injured in combat during the war. And after that, he was discharged and he came back home, and his troubles really seemed to commence then. And he found his way to the asylum, and then eventually died in the asylum. Really, one of the kind of poignant elements of Mr. Ruby's story, actually, is that after he died in the asylum, his daughter came to struggle with her own mental health struggles, and then found her way to the asylum, actually very young, really. And then only perhaps several years after Mr. Ruby himself died, she also died. So that, I think, is a story that I think is really, really quite gut-wrenching, really, and that I'm eager to tell folks about. There are certainly, and there are definitely others as well. There's a Mr. Lowenthal, who was a professor of languages here locally in Rochester, and actually his details of his troubles actually were made the newspapers actually as well. So the information that we were able to glean about him in the records was, you know, very incomplete, but we were able to fill in some of that detail with you know, other sources, including ancestry and newspaper accounts of his struggles, and so we'll certainly tell you about him. And so there really are lots of others who I think are, again, just to echo what Larry said, I think that, you know, these are folks who are in the county insane asylum, and I think that so much of the stigma of mental illness, one of the critical causes is the idea that we commonly see people as the other, you know, that we see people as, you know, very different from us, and especially people with serious mental illness is, you know, very different. But one of the things I'm so excited about really is to really, you know, tell stories about these people. When you tell stories about people, I think that you make it very, very obvious that these were human beings, that this is not the other. This is me. This is, you know, could be my children, my parents, my aunts and uncles, my cousins, and so on. And so I think that, you know, stories really have that power, really. And so, you know, certainly not just the Rubies, not just Mr. Lowenthal, but, you know, many others for whom we have some really compelling stories, and I'm really eager to tell those stories.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan, and thank you so much, Larry, for being here today. We are thrilled to be working with you and look forward to putting together Season 3 of Who Lies Beneath in partnership with both of you. So more to come on that. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you guys for your work.
Yeah, we're very excited. Thank you.
So, Doug, this is really exciting to see the work done in Athens is helping to inspire others to do the same in other locations.
It sure is. But we need to note that projects like this have happened in the past. But let's hope these stories and the dedication of others will be, let's hope, a catalyst to even more people to take up the challenge.
Yeah, let's hope so, because there are so many. I keep hearing about more and more from people who listen to the podcast of just places across the country, in Ohio and across the country, that have cemeteries like this with unmarked graves. So thank you, Doug, so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
As we mentioned, this is our last episode of season two, and now that we're hearing about what's going on in New York, we know there is so much more work to be done to give a voice to those who were voiceless. We continue to want to hear your stories about relatives in your families who you believe may be buried under an unmarked grave at cemeteries across the country. Email us at wholiesbeneath@woub.org. Thank you for listening, and until next time, take care of each other. Who Lies Beneath the Asylum is a production of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, written by me, Sherry Russo. Adam Rich is our audio engineer. Artwork is by Sean Anderson. Special thanks to Doug McCabe, Greg Polzer, Jimmy Stewart, Ryan Thibodeau, and Lawrence Guttmacher for contributing their knowledge and voices to this podcast. If you like the show, please rate and subscribe or visit woub.org to learn more.